Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Thursday, June 2nd of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the U.S. Department of the Interior is looking into ways to fund housing solutions in National Park Gateway communities across the country. This time on the Cannabis Report, we'll hear about the results of a new CU Boulder study that found the way cannabis is currently labeled does not adequately reflect the product's chemical makeup. And John Lindorf will be in the studio to catch us up on local food news. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. If Radio Nibbles leaves you hungry for more, host John Lindorf and Chef Daniel Asher will be speaking with Chef Paolo Neville and cacao expert Michael Keynes during the hour of A Public Affair. The panel will discuss sustainability issues in the food business, the challenges of feeding people during COVID, and why it's great to add fungi to bean-to-bar chocolate. Listeners can call in with food questions. At 9:30, Dennis Ryder will be in the Boulder studio to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first these local and regional headlines with KGNU's Christian Gadiwai.
Governor Jared Polis signed a bundle of affordable housing measures into law on Wednesday. Among them was a bill that will invest nearly $180 million of COVID relief money to fund housing construction projects and support local housing efforts. The law, HB 1304, will use the funding to provide flexible and direct grants to nonprofit organizations and local governments all over the state of Colorado. The funds will be put into projects that include developing housing for those heavily impacted by COVID-19, development patterns, and infrastructure projects. Governor Polis has also signed a bipartisan measure to loosen residency requirements for in-state tuition. The new law allows any graduate of a Colorado high school to qualify for in-state tuition at public universities in Colorado. Students who have been physically present in Colorado for at least 1 year immediately preceding successful completion of a high school equivalency examination will also qualify. The previous criteria mandated 3 consecutive years of residency to qualify for in-state tuition. The new residency criteria will also include undocumented students who meet the same criteria as their documented counterparts. Colorado State Patrol announced in a press conference Wednesday that they have seized 400% more fentanyl than they had this time last year. In 2019, Colorado State Patrol seized 11 pounds of fentanyl. That number shot up in 2021 and is even higher this year. Colorado State Patrol Colonel Matthew Packard called the amount seized a drop in the bucket compared to what's circulating in the community. Packard mentioned that the increased seizures only count drugs that they find in car searches. Colorado's overdose was higher than the national average in 2021, according to the Colorado State Patrol. 900 people have already died from fentanyl overdoses this year. Larimer County jail officials have arrested 12 individuals on suspicion of smuggling narcotics into the facility. Luis Licon has more.
Officials launched an investigation after a deputy at Larimer County Jail tipped off investigators about inmates acting suspiciously and communicating with people outside of the jail. The Larimer County Sheriff's Office spent several weeks listening to phone calls and reviewing mail that was coming into the facility. Officials tested the mail for narcotics and found that some of the drugs were allegedly infused into the ink used in the cards, according to CBS Denver. As a result of the investigation, the jail will no longer allow inmates to receive paper letters. Instead, they can read their mail via a tablet after it is sent to a Texas facility and transferred into a digital format. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
The Boulder Public Library has kicked off its Summer of Discovery program with a reading and activities challenge, Our Connected World. In its 6th consecutive year, the program runs from June 1st to July 31st and features a multitude of events, activities, and prizes for those who participate. All those who join the program have to complete a reading goal in order to win prizes. The reading material can range from books, magazines, and other forms of literary media. As long as participants log it, it counts. Some of the events in the program include visits from multiple authors and illustrators, an Encanto sing-along event, goats in the library, and a bicycle rodeo with Boulder police officers. Overall, the library hopes to achieve a community reading goal of 2 million minutes. More information is available on the Boulder Public Library website. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is raising awareness this month for the ozone pollution season this year. In collaboration with the Regional Air Quality Council, they will send a daily ozone forecast from June 1st to August 31st that people can find on social media, their email list, or an advisory hotline. The CDPHE advises people to avoid spending prolonged time outside during the hottest times of day as to avoid long enough exposure to ozone pollution, which can damage people's lungs. To get daily updates on air quality, call 303-758-2403. All along the Front Range today, expect sunny weather with slightly colder temperatures and winds that could reach up to 4 miles per hour. In Boulder, a high near 71 and a low around 49. In Denver, a high near 73 and a low around 50. In Fort Collins, a high near 73 and a low around 48. Outside the Boulder studio, it's 46 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Christian Garibay.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Like many employers in the Mountain West, Grand Teton National Park is struggling to house and retain its workforce. But the challenge isn't unique to that park. The U.S. Department of the Interior is looking into ways to fund innovative lodging solutions both in Teton County and in other National Park Gateway communities across the country. Will Walkie from Rocky Mountain Community Radio sister station KHOL in Jackson, Wyoming, has more.
Sam Ritchie's home is steps away from the National Elk Refuge. She says it has everything she needs, a bedroom, kitchen, and sitting area with a comfortable couch.
It's wonderfully cozy, and it's hilarious because at work, I work on log cabins all day and come to live in one every night.
She first took a job with the National Park Service in the summer of 2017 when she was a backcountry ranger in Yellowstone. It was isolating work. Grocery trips meant an hour and a half drive to Jackson. But she loved it anyway.
I've managed to live in incredibly beautiful places and work with my hands most of the day and work outside most of the day. And I kind of realized that that was a priority for me.
Ritchie's performed historic preservation work for the Park Service in western Wyoming for the past few years. And this spring, she's starting a new full-time position doing trail work for Grand Teton National Park. Last month, there was also a major development that boosted her quality of life outside of work. She moved into a full-time place to live.
In the last year, I've really considered looking at other parks that have more stable housing situations in the surrounding neighborhoods and cities. But thankfully, it lucked out that the park was able to offer me housing, and I'm currently living in park housing, which is actually affordable and kind of allows me to exhale a little bit.
Ritchie says she was displaced 4 times in 2 years while navigating market rate housing in Jackson. Her former landlords sold their properties or jacked up the rents, and tenants in Wyoming don't have many rights to challenge those decisions. As a result, Grand Teton Superintendent Chip Jenkins says many of his employees are struggling to find permanent lodging right now.
Unless a person really comes from unusual circumstances and are able to be able to muster the capital to get into the private market, that's not a choice that is open to our employees.
The median home sale price in Teton County eclipsed $4 million this year. Just about 14% of the park's employees choose to live in private housing, Jenkins says. But by 2026, that number will be down to about 5%.
And what's happening now is that every time we have a turnover in positions, so for example, we had our chief ranger who has been a longtime resident in town. When they have moved on to other jobs, when we hire our new chief ranger who came down from Alaska, she can't afford to get into the housing market. She, her husband, and her son, they can't afford to rent or to buy. So we need to be able to provide their housing.
Jenkins estimates that he needs 35 new households in the next 4 years just to retain his current staff. And that's not accounting for future needs. 3.8 million people visited Grand Teton in 2021, a record amount. So, Jenkins says it's logical that the park will need to add more staff eventually.
You know, I think we have a need for more custodians, for more law enforcement rangers. Frankly, part of what we need is we need more digital rangers. We need people who are helping in order to be able to provide information to people so that they can plan their trips.
Grand Teton has a full-time housing officer who maintains current stock, matches employees with rooms, and manages any issues that come up. Jenkins is also working with the Park Service's headquarters in Washington, D.C. to strategize how to quickly build more units. He says that's critical, not only to keep his organization running, but for the local community as well.
It's our responsibility to keep the roads open from Moran down to, you know, down to town. We have mutual aid agreements with the sheriff and the police department and the emergency medical services and the fire department. And I think this last year we responded to over 50 emergency calls just up in Buffalo Valley.
Speaking in testimony in mid-May before a congressional committee, National Park Service Director Chuck Sam said he's asking for additional funding for employee housing in his annual budget. Millions are specifically allocated for Grand Teton and other western areas.
Median home purchase prices continue to rise throughout the United States and many of our gateway communities. And short-term vacation rental markets are thriving and therefore taking away from our seasonal work staff who usually wouldn't be able to find a housing in our gateway communities.
Beyond more funding, the federal government is also looking into alternative ways to develop. In Maine, lawmakers are proposing a land transfer from Acadia National Park to a local organization so they can build more workforce housing units in the nearby town of Bar Harbor. That's a difficult strategy under current regulations, but earlier this month, Associate Director of Park Planning, Facilities and Lands for the Park Service, Michael Caldwell, told a U.S. Senate committee he'd like to explore options like that more often.
We're working with others to try to maybe gain some more flexibilities and authorities that are needed for public-public and public-private partnerships to help us with our housing needs.
To that end, two Western members of Congress introduced a bipartisan act last month that would cut red tape around private-public partnerships with the goal of building quickly in gateway communities like Jackson. But it hasn't gained traction yet. Meanwhile, Grand Teton National Park is dealing with another issue connected to the cost of living in Jackson, employee recruitment. Jenkins says he has about 25 open positions for the summer season, lodging included, but no candidates to take them. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Will Walkie in Jackson, Wyoming.
And now it's time for the Cannabis Report here on KGNU Community Radio. As always, I'm joined by cannabis correspondent Leland Rucker. Leland, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Good to be here.
So this morning, we're going to talk about what's actually in pot. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm finding this very interesting. I think the whole subject is fascinating. If you go to dispensaries, if you've been to a dispensary, you've gotten the talk. Indica sativa hybrid. If you haven't gone to a dispensary, if you go there, you're going to get the talk. That's just the way it is. And basically, in dispensaries, they came up with a way to have three basic categories, sativa, indica, or hybrid, a combination of those. And it's become standard. I mean, they say sativas are said to give you more energy and that probably it's better in the afternoon, the daytime, and indicas are more retrospective, I guess, and better when you don't need to work, when you just want to space out. And it brings up the question, is this the best way for consumers to know what they're getting? You know, you get some kind of a product and it says kind of what's in it, but you don't really know, and we don't really understand that. And nowadays, there's a train of thought that says it has nothing to do with indica or sativa or hybrids. It's a thing called the entourage effect. And its basic tenet is it's the combination of all the cannabinoids working together like they do in the plant. And the concept that chemical substances in cannabis, especially cannabinoids like THC and CBD, those are both cannabinoids, and terpenes, which are the oils that give different strains of cannabis their distinctive fragrance. They do this for everything. All plants have some kind of terpenes. And this, the entourage effect says that they work better in concert when they're not isolated from one another. When you get the whole plant, people will say the whole plant. That's what they're talking about, is a combination of CBD and THC. And this seems to rub against the basic way that drugs and medicines are created today. Because when you think about it, they isolate, they test compounds, and then they develop drugs and patent those drugs from the compounds that they find. And so many scientists are still openly skeptical of most entourage effect claims because we haven't done much testing on it. I talked to a woman who is a scientist, and she says, I'm not against marijuana. I want to study it carefully. We know it can affect pain and appetite, but the large majority of what's being said is driven by anecdotal marketing. These guys are really trying to make money. And I took that to heart. I thought, well, you know, there's some truth to that because we really haven't studied this plant enough to know exactly what's going on. And if this goes against basic medical practice, people are going to be skeptical who are in the medical industry. You know, all plants contain chemical compounds. They use them themselves for defense against animals, smells, other organisms. We're just learning how plants are doing this. And cannabis has more compounds than most plants. That's what's really interesting about it. Besides the two best, which is THC, which gives us the cannabis high, and cannabidiol, which is CBD, which is generally associated with its healing qualities. But there's more than 100 different chemical compounds, THCA, CBDA, CBN, CBG, all of these things that have been found, but again, we're still just sort of going along. And in 1988, scientists discovered that the human body has an endocannabinoid system. I thought this was crazy when I first heard about it, but it's true. It's a system that helps keep the body in balance, like controlling appetite, sleep, cognition, anxiety, and the body produces its own cannabinoids. They're called endocannabinoids that are similar to those produced by cannabis. They're not the same, but they're similar, and they both activate CB1 receptors that are found in the brain and CB2 receptors that are found throughout the rest of the body. And recently, a CU group that has been studying cannabis, they studied the chemical composition of marijuana products of 90,000 samples across 6 states. The co-author, Brian Keegan, says, our findings suggest that the prevailing labeling system is not an effective or safe way to provide information about these products. This is a real challenge for an industry that's trying to professionalize itself. And he's absolutely correct about that. They sorted through 90,000 samples from 6 states according to their cannabinoid and terpene makeup and found, not surprisingly, that the vast majority of the cannabinoids in recreational cannabis are the psychoactive THC.
And am I correct that this study also found that some of the funny names, not just indica, sativa, and hybrid, but like golden goat and purple Urkel and these sorts of names that you hear on cannabis, that they might be totally different at different dispensaries? So let's say you buy golden goat and you see it on a list, you know, at another dispensary, those might not give you the same effect at all.
Yeah, you might think that when you're buying it, but we don't know. We really just don't know. And basically, they started looking at the terpene content, and that's this fragrance thing that makes you like things or dislike things. And they found products tend to fall into 3 distinct terpene categories. But they also found that the categories don't correspond necessarily to the indica, sativa, and hybrid labeling scheme. So this is still just something, well, like the authors wrote, it's likely that a sample with the label indica will have an indistinguishable terpene composition as samples labeled sativa or hybrid. And I think this is really a fascinating subject. We're just getting going on it, and we need more research. The researchers themselves say, you know, prove us wrong. Let's find out more about what this plant can actually do.
Yeah, really interesting. I'd imagine that people that are support cannabis and interested in it and like it, and people who don't, would both be interested in making sure that we have some uniformity in knowing what we're getting is concerned.
Sure, we should all know that. And again, this is just something that for 100 years, you know, it was an off subject. Scientists couldn't do anything about it. And now we're finally getting around to it. Wow.
Really interesting stuff. Well, Leland, we really appreciate your time. Thanks, Leland.
Thank you.
For KGNU, I'm Hanley Myers.
Have a banana.
Almost everybody does eat when they go to John Lindorf's house. On today's Radio Nibbles, John is here to talk about what he's been cooking and growing lately. Good morning, John.
It's been kind of a wet week in the Lindorf garden. You know, it's been a little hard to locate the sun for my plants. And so,
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing, you know, that we have the moisture. But I did want to talk about that because we have the KGNU plant sale.
We do indeed.
Which is Sunday? I believe.
I should know that answer to that. It's the 5th. Yes. I'm looking for the for the notice.
Yeah. And so it's going to be down here at the station in Boulder. And there's going to be plant starts and folks here who know about gardening. And I just want to encourage you to go ahead and come down. And, you know, a lot of people don't have a big chunk of ground.
Yeah.
And you really can grow a lot on a sunny patio. And I'll be reporting on that as I go along about my tomatoes and nasturtium and peppers and things.
Okay. Anything else of edible of note that we need to know about that you're growing in your garden?
You know, I also have some sunflowers. The latest addition to my garden I just got yesterday. My son Hans got married on Sunday, and to a wonderful woman, Becca. And they couldn't stand the thought of, doing a lot of cut flowers and then having them thrown away. So they bought plants.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I got some of the plants. So I have actual flowers. The other thing that, because all this family visited, well, for one thing, I was deeply involved in trying to make sure that the food was good at the wedding. And that was, it was a fascinating process simply because, you know, when I got married 30 years ago, we thought of food that we wanted to eat, and we served it. And, you know, there wasn't a tremendous amount of thought about
dietary restrictions.
Yeah. In this case, it was like a spreadsheet, you know, with the vegan vegetarians and, you know, no pork and all that stuff. But it all worked out fine. And so I've ended up having house guests and my family in the house, feeding them. But Hans and Becca stopped by on their way back to Portland. And they were like, you know, just pondering what had just happened there. And I said, you want some mac and cheese? And so I made, this is my what I learned about cooking this weekend is, you know, most mac and cheese is made with little elbows or something like that. I made them with these humongous pasta shells that are normally stuffed. And I baked them with milk and cheese and crumbled corn chips on top. And it was just great to see that look of satisfaction on their face when I gave them that.
Yeah, the comfort of comfort food.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to speak at length about food in the next hour. But first, tell me what's in your Boulder Weekly column today.
Today is it's very cool. I've been collecting information about advances in food technology and stuff. And these are all real things in my column today about the future of food, things that people are doing now. Cultured, fermented, 3D printed, and the use of robotics to make the food and serve the food. I mean, I was going to title it, you know, Scary Food Is Now, because some of it is very odd.
Yeah.
Things like, there's a company in England that's using banana peels and turning them into essentially pulled pork to use in eating, kind of like jackfruit is used, you know, and finding ways to repurpose waste. There's a distillery in Portland, Oregon, that's using whey. Whey is the byproduct of making cheese.
Yeah, and yogurt.
Yeah. And, they're fermenting it and turning it into vodka. other people that are turning seaweed into bacon.
I don't know if it, like, listeners can hear my side eye and my wrinkled nose.
Yeah,
but,
it's very side-eyed, and you should see her. She's like going. In any case, I encourage you to read it today in the Boulder Weekly.
Well, in our final minute, tell me, what's the best thing you ate this week?
You know, you don't see a lot of Brazilian food around here, and I was in Wheat Ridge, and I look, and I go, Little Brazil. And I went, well, you know, I had to go in. They have a lot of the traditional Brazilian dishes, feijoada, you know, and all of that. But naturally, the thing I went to for was the pies. It's called a pastis. It's a fried pie. But this had, like, mango and essentially mozzarella in it. Another one had plantains. They were, you know, curried ones. And it's so it's a Little Brazil in Wheat Ridge.
Well, you can stay tuned for a public affair listener. We will have a one-hour call-in show hosted by John Lindorf and Chef Daniel Asher, and two guests, Chef Paulo Neville and cacao expert Michael Keynes of Moshka Chocolate. That's going to be coming right up after these BBC News headlines. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young.
BBC News.